You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You can hear this show every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are commercial free. We're a collective, and we have been operating without a license from the U.S. government since 1995. This program has been broadcast here since 1997, and this show is dedicated to exploring social change and spirituality, compassion, and anarchy. Free Radio Santa Cruz operates by donations from you, the listener, and we always appreciate donations of any amount. They help us thrive and survive. You can make donations online at freakradio.org or mail them here to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. My very special guest on the telephone this evening is Alan Clements. And Alan is an author, a performing artist, media activist, and founder of World Dharma Vision. And he was the first American to ordain as a Buddhist monk in Burma. He lived there for nearly 5 years in a Rangoon monastery, and he trained in Buddhist psychology and mindfulness meditation. In 1984, he was forced to leave that country by the dictatorship there. And he's also the co-founder of the Burma Project USA. And some of his books include Burma, The Next Killing Fields, and Voice of Hope, which is a compilation of conversations with Aung San Suu Kyi. His new book is called A Future to Believe In, and it's 108 reflections on the art and activism of freedom. And Alan Clements, I want to warmly welcome you back to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate having me on.
I'm really grateful to hear your voice and speak with you again, and I'm grateful for this book that I have read closely, A Future to Believe In. And I want to hear from you this evening about different aspects that you're writing about in the book, as well as some of your reflections on current happenings, revolution, changes in Burma, and such. I want to start by asking you about in A Future to Believe In. You are, it's a wonderful book for me to read, where you have brought together some of the most incredible voices that I can think of to bring out some of the most important points that human beings are dealing with now. And I have to say, I really love the diversity of vantage points and voices that you've quoted from Carl Sagan, Aung San Suu Kyi, Leo Tolstoy, Rollo May, Anne Frank, Kali Lassen from Adbusters, Aidan Ballou, who actually, I don't think barely any people I speak to know who Aidan Ballou is. I was surprised and delighted to see his quote in there, and John Cage. So I thank you for the diversity that you're bringing into this book.
Thank these people, huh? Very brilliant minds and wonderful hearts. You know, I'm sorry to cut you off. Did you have a question, or did you?
I do, but you, please go
ahead.
Well,
you know, you're bringing up these wonderful minds and hearts here. You know, the uniqueness of this book for me was that about 7 years ago, the concept of a leaderless freedom came to me when we started the World Dharma Online Institute. And in many ways, it was born from my time in Burma with Aung San Suu Kyi after her first release from house arrest back in 1995, after 6 years of incarceration. And I encountered the concept, John, that was being used in Burma's nonviolent struggle to overcome oppression, dictatorship, and totalitarianism. They used the phrase, a revolution of the spirit, which essentially meant a deep integrity and a responsibility for the role of consciousness in spiritual development and political transformation. And it was the study, really, of this transformational intelligence, this interactivity, life meeting life, this world dharma, like world music, the synergy of people playing on a stage and making a sound that's never been done before. And so this book was born from this desire to find a leaderless liberation, a dharma, a world dharma. And so I sat down and said, okay, what do I know and who do I want to interrelate with? And over the course of 5 years, it came out to be somewhat of an ontological symphony, if you will. And we included, I included, I think close to 300 different voices in this book, to the point where I almost didn't want to put my name on it. I wanted it to be a global book, a global evolutional, revolutional book, so that it took away the whole stigma of teacher, guru, personage, hierarchy, all the various things that come along with I know and you don't, follow me and you'll learn, teacher-student dynamics. And so I wanted to write a book that I could read and give to my daughter, who's just young and five. And so I said, okay, great. Let's put all the best hearts and minds and creative energy together, risk takers, thinkers, scientists, artists, unknown, known, and let's dance for 5 years. And 3,000 pages later, it got distilled into 108 reflections on, as you mentioned, the art and activism of freedom. And freedom became the operative energy in this book. What is freedom? And that was the love that I saw with Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, that we had a woman who inspired a nation to stand up for this incredible, colorless, odorless, immaculate, can't-live-without-it energy called essential, inalienable human rights, freedom, the oxygen of civilized existence. And so this book is really an expression of what is this consciousness that we can inhabit and occupy, learn from, grow from, and transform, and invest in like we do the ecosystem, the environment. And so it's a book about mental environmentalism, if I will.
Near the beginning of A Future to Believe In, you are quoting from people and writing about the need, the desire to participate in our own evolution. And you quote from Brian Swim, who's talking about how we participate in creating our own self as well. That seems to be an important nugget that runs through your writings generally in this book as well. And it touches on, for me, the Occupy movement that became fairly intense in the United States and other places during the last part of the year. And people are reigniting that in different areas as well. And I'm wondering if you would say a little more about this, what I see as a move from being consumers and observers to participating in life and helping to be part of the evolution. If you'd say a bit about more about that, and if you have any thoughts on lessons learned from the Occupy movement or ways that it resonated or didn't for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my movement across the landscape of politics and culture, University of Virginia in the early 70s revolution on campus, as you remember, not too dissimilar today with these psychotic incursions into other cultures and based on lies that are forgotten, to gouge the earth and perhaps kill innocents, to perpetuate the petroleum buzz and addiction of our lives. This transition from essential human American culture I was in to a descent, if you will, a repulsion, frankly, to the lie as I perceived it. And I think that's what the Occupy movement, which I would say in a sense is alive to the extent that we understand and honor and are inspired by the beauty of life, and that consciousness animates this moment now that allows us to speak and interrelate. I think that comes close to the ineffable, John, and therefore the rare use of the word the sacred. So we're inhabiting existence. We're choosing the vocation of life rather than livelihood alone, money alone, power-driven politics alone. You know, in Burma today, we see this remarkable, I would not call it a transition as much as a fruition of 23 years of ardent, non-aggressive-based revolution to overcome one of the most maniacal military dictatorships in the modern era. And I think we can take a great example from seeing what's going on there into our lives here in Europe, Australia, Canada, America, the Occupy movement that will continue to the extent that we see that inherently in power there is nothing. In Burma, the dictator has everything, billions of dollars, control of an army, built himself a Hitler-like bunker, and he's alone in this silent, affluent hell. And I think what happened is that he's saying, my God, my Buddha, my Dharma, my emptiness, my terror, there's nothing left. It's been a bad year for dictators. Mubarak, Gaddafi, pray Assad relaxes his terror and walks into the Red Sea and swims somewhere else. And so the Occupy movement, and I think the spiritual revolution that we've all been a part of for a long time and perhaps will continue until there's true, genuine peace on earth, we can throw away the weapons, nuclear weapons included, and say, wow, life is a miracle, and that there's a way to participate in the evolution of this process and perhaps create such a peace, such a majestic interspace with each other, with species, with the environment, and with the mystery of the unknown, and go, wow, where's our innate Magellan, our Galileo, and set sail into new dimensions and new areas, new trajectories, and find new pathways to inhabit greater areas of the cosmos. I think that's what we're on about. That's the edge of where the Dharma is in my life. I think the Occupy movement expressed an incredibly repressed dissent, rage, and justice to the lies, the economic lies, the material lies, the lie, the lie, the lie. And it's like, okay, great. Now we need to do what we can to transform by example. Now, you know, in Buddhist culture, they use the trilogy, the three components of transformation to be dana, that of active generosity, of sila, the power of conscience and integrity, and of course, bhavana, the beautification of consciousness. I think when we talk about the Occupy movement, at least as I hear it, it's about dana, sila, bhavana, found in contemporary language, the beauty of giving. You know, inspire people to give through the example of giving. Inspire integrity and conscience by being a person of conscience. Inspire the aesthetics of emotional, psychological, spiritual development by taking the time to understand more and more of the intelligence, the transformational intelligence of the gift of the human mind. And so I think that's sort of where the book, A Future to Believe In, and where it converges in Burma with Aung San Suu Kyi and the people's seemingly a remarkable moment of success in this revolution, and the deep in-breath of the Occupy movement right now to understand and perhaps exhale into a new form of interaction that really is about pro-transformational consciousness in action. And perhaps we might see a remarkable revolution in this culture where greed is relaxed into giving, and that cruelty is transformed into kindness, and that, who knows, maybe in this upcoming election, one of the great, great wisdoms will be that there's the abolishment of the nuclear issue, the reclaiming of all weapons. I mean, why not enter the dialogue at the highest level to create the best peace on earth for our children and the children's children? That's our future to believe in. Occupy the best of our hearts and show by example.
In your latest book, A Future to Believe In, in section number 29, called Limitless Mutuality, Alan, you write that we cannot live without each other. And you write that defining ourselves as nations, sects, and tribes with fixed or rigid ideological borders is in large part why we are teetering on self-extinction. We must really come to understand the shared nature of existence. Nothing stands apart. I wonder if you would say more about national borders and the problem of that, and also mutual coexistence. And you were touching on it a moment ago, but I'm wondering what you think the real potential is for nonviolent revolution in the United States, to have a mind shift, as you call it in this book, from greed to generosity, as you were just speaking on.
Well, those are perennial favorite topics. I mean, they're powerful, important, crucial. I mean, I did a brief period of time as a advisor, journalist, and observer in the former Yugoslavia during the last year of their war, John. And I saw some nothing like frontline people, but living in Zagreb for that year, then later on in Sarajevo, it was pretty moving and touching and troubling to see that half the city of a million people, half a million of them were refugees living on the street in frigid weather and traumatized from what had happened in their own villages and homes. It was, as most people know, it was something like 43 months of televised ethnic cleansing. For them, it was genocide up close. And my point is that Croats, Bosnian Muslims, Bosnian Serbs, Croatian Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Muslims, concepts, labels, the hysteria of a concept, borders between nations, Canada and America. You can't go there and actually find some distinction. Where is it? It's an idea in the mind. It's an abstraction. We're removed from reality, and we live in the unreality of distinctions and imbue projections within those aberrations. We move into a psychosis and begin to live in the fantasy of being violated, when in fact we're just reacting to our own ignorance, delusion, and arrogance, to put a psychological label onto this in its most simple form. We think of blacks or reds or yellows or Czechs or Americans or Southerners or Palestinians or Israelis. We imbue ideas that don't exist beneath the biological, psychical skin, and the world goes round and round, and the Buddha called it samsara, the great hallucination, the great delusion. And we kill in the name of these delusions, obviously. And so in the simplest way, you know, I saw people whom had killed family members, but when everything was lost and they saw through this facade, John, they embraced each other in this deep reconciliation at the folly of killing in the name of, in the name of, in the name of. And I think that's the great projection that we as nationalist Americans, Canadians, Iranians, Burmese, Tibetans, whatever, Chinese, to come out of this division and find a rhythm as a life evolving and try to understand equality and justice and peace and harmony and co-resonant qualities. Love and compassion are no more Buddhist than they are Islamic. And so that's the great awakening today, I think, in simple terms, is how and where can we find the uniformity of values? What is spiritual intelligence? What is a dharma without logo? What is a freedom that is truly global? We all understand that the pollution in Beijing affects the quality of air in a North American city, but very few of us understand that the rape of a Tibetan nun in Lhasa tonight would affect the quality of our human rights here in Vancouver. And so that's when I use the comparison, the analogy of freedom and human rights to be the oxygen of civilized existence. I think that's the new psychical ecosphere that we must integrate into our lives, is to see that freedom is universal and that these divisions and these artificial barriers may have a relative value, but by and large, they're not only anachronistic, and I think they should be seen ultimately as fossils. But someone has to trust and begin to lay down the weapons and begin to go hand in hand, like we saw with de Klerk and Mandela. And perhaps in Burma today with Thein Sein, the president of the new civilian government, and Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of the democracy movement and Nobel laureate. Maybe we'll see something that even exceeds the hand in hand moment. And there's a deep global reconciliation born from this unthinkable healing in Burma. I would think that in this heartbeat, there could be a global change if we all just kind of, wow, just opened ourselves, that who can witness and feel that one person raped or killed is too many. And so the end of violence, and to see that Burma did this nonviolently, is just mind-blowing. In terms of our nonviolent revolution in America, somehow as the heart beats, it reminds me of the music of just living and how frail and fragile we are as people. I have a young daughter, you have a young son. I looked at her today and just had this moment that this child is the child of all parents, and all children are my children, the trees, the animals, the birds, this deep interconnectedness. And what is revolution? What is nonviolence? It's like caring for a child, all children, all people, as if it's your own family, and somehow seeing that I cannot live without you. That we just can't kill all the bad people, remove evil that way. We have to understand, I think, a way to transform and see people as not black and white, but as diverse, complicated, dual, and try to understand ways to relax this duality. And as Aung San Suu Kyi said, let's relax destruction and learn to dialogue. And I think that's the simple mantra of the revolution. Let's talk. Let's show by example and show the power of language to heal, the power of feelings. If I can conclude with this one little short story, John. When I first met Aung San Suu Kyi in 1995, I had been listening to her in front of her gate where she was incarcerated for 6 years, and she would walk to the gate, stand on a little stairs, and she would speak to the people that dared gather. It was a bit like occupy Wall Street, but occupy downtown Rangoon in front of Aung San Suu Kyi's house at 54 University Avenue. First, there were 20, 100, 1,000 people there. All of them defying military law, which was 5 years in prison, likely to be tortured. And there they were defying that level of oppression and listening to her talk about the power of love and compassion. Well, eventually I had a chance to meet her behind that gate. And the first thing I asked her was, Aung San Suu Kyi, you use the power of the spirit. You call it a revolution of the spirit, this nonviolent struggle for freedom and democracy. What, in essence, is this revolution? And she said, you were just out on the street with the people who dared to confront their fear, to stand up to military injustice, to commune in the spirit of nonviolent revolution. They were living freely. They weren't doing something to bring freedom, she said. Number one, the essence of revolution is courage. She said the courage is to see this circumstance. They don't like the oppression. They show their dissent nonviolently by living freely. They came together as a community. So the essence of revolution is to see, to feel, and she said to act. And the essence of that is courage, the courage to care about something larger than your own self-interest and to act upon that insight. That's what I would say, she said, to be the essence of nonviolent revolution, the courage to care. And so I think that is a profound message from this remarkable woman that could very well be the intelligence to inform the next outbreath of the Occupy movement in America, in cities, in our own personal lives, in our homes, around the world, so that the world essentially becomes a place of peace and justice and equality. And I think if it was done in Burma, and it seems to be being done in a way that's truly amazing, well, I think we can see it all over the world if we try.
My name is John Malkin. This program is called The Great Leap Forward, and you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM or freakradio.org. I'm speaking with Alan Clements, author of a brand new book called A Future to Believe In. And you can see more about the book online at futuretobelievein.com. More on Alan is at alanclements.com. His last name is C-L-E-M-E-N-T-S. Alan is also the author of other books, including Instinct for Freedom and The Voice of Hope, Conversations with Aung San Suu Kyi. Alan, Mohandas Gandhi has inspired me a lot in my lifetime, and his actions and writings on nonviolence have inspired a lot of people. There is a particular quote in your book, A Future to Believe In, that really is powerful for me. It cuts through to a particular essence of nonviolence that is sometimes missing from nonviolent movements, actually. You quote him as saying, "We must always seek to ally ourselves with that part of the enemy that knows what is right." There's this, as you were speaking about, this possibility of expanding out our circle of those we are generous towards, kind, towards forgiving towards, and expanding that circle out from our direct family and friends to a broader realm, including even people whom we disagree with, or in extreme cases, things that you experienced directly in Yugoslavia and other places where people have done very harmful, destructive things to each other, and still forgiveness is extended. Would you say a little about forgiveness and this particular quality of loving one's enemy?
Well, my first thought is that that is a remarkably challenging, at the very least, I wanted to say possibility, but necessity. There are examples. You've noted one. I think that there is probably a quality that precedes or extends or exceeds forgiveness in that the more that one understands one's own foibles, weaknesses, the shadow of their own ideas of certainty, their humanness, the more that one embraces their humanness, my sense that it builds innately or naturally, I should say, a confidence, a self-confidence that's erected upon, built upon the reality of non-perfection, if you will. And to the extent that we can see and feel this, the innate humanness of our own being, that we're not driven by the artificiality of a projection of grandiosity, or and it metastasizes into a malignant sense of narcissism. We've seen examples of this form of absolute-ism, whether it be in the church with the Pope or with a dictatorship. The world is littered with the death from those levels of mass hysteria. So the opposite of absolutism and certainty and megalomania is a high regard for our humanness. And I think that wisdom, if you will, John, begins to be the operative lens in which we begin to interrelate with others, and therefore it seems to exceed the need specifically to forgive, because we see that we too are infinitely capable of the complexities that we see in the world. And that was one of the things I did see in myself, both in the Yugoslavia and several times in my forays into Burma, along the jungles there at times when there was guerrilla war. You see that there comes a time for some where the choice to stand up for their values in these cases, genocidal attack, warranted an armed response. And so it's an extremely complicated dialogue to understand when is it appropriate to fight back? When is it appropriate to send thoughts of love? When is it appropriate to use the power of rage as a transformational expression that I do not approve of what you're doing? I will not kill you, but I am really angry. I think this coming to terms with examples of trust in the emotional expression of our being, and do all that we can, do everything we can to understand the mechanisms of how anger and greed and fear, if not checked, lead to justified forms of harm. And I think that's the number one thing for me about nonviolence, is that I just do not feel comfortable to live on a planet where there is aggression, harm, violence, murder, rape. And I think until we see the absolute end of violence, all of us should take stock, deep spiritual stock, understand the mechanisms of how we too could be in that process. And, you know, let's remove greed, anger, and delusion from the genome and see what kind of party we can create with a consciousness that's free to just explore infinity without fear. And just put a rest to the story of this little blip in evolutional time where humankind conceived of the weapon born from anger and fear and delusion and said, okay, great. Footnote in human history, done, gone, and move into the cosmos with peace. So there's a lot to be said for violence and the overcoming of understanding how I could be the participant of that very energy. And if one is in doubt about this, take it out of theory. You know, I've often advocated that politicians, priests, popes should mandatory, that they should go to refugee camps, go to areas where there have been unremitting horror, bombing, torture, napalm, incarceration, and look at what weapons do to human life, to life, the environment. I remember looking out at the DMZ in Vietnam. As far as the eye could see, John, just pockmarked from B-52 bombs. The land just concretized from Agent Orange, where for 10 unremitting years, we as a culture, a government, tried to bomb a nation into oblivion. How crazy is that? So the prehistoric state of consciousness we're talking about, it's give peace a chance by understanding how the mind operates, and should be mandatory in schools, the study of human rights, the study of human consciousness, especially from the angle of the transformational Dharma intelligence of how to beautify consciousness, to instill integrity, and to see the beauty of giving, Dana Sila Bhavana, you know, the operative energy of Burma's revolution, and perhaps the three most powerful expressions of consciousness that we as participants in the evolving Occupy movement can find strength and wisdom in from Burma's revolution. I hope that makes sense, and I hope it resonates, because, again, the operative point here for me is, in doubt about the power of nonviolence, go visit some war zones where people are injured based upon the bomb. See what it does. Put our mind and body in those children as if it's our own child. And see what justification means at that point. So I say bring home the troops and speak about peace, President. Speak about peace, people. And vote for the people who speak about peace, not about killing.
What you're saying resonates with me very, very much, Alan. And recently I formulated a short question that I am thinking of presenting to someone or some people who are advocating violence or war as a means for ending violence or war. I have this picture, this question. Tell me your favorite quotes from people who've been killed trying to make peace through war. And of course it's just impossible because those people were themselves killed in that process and can't comment on it, of course. And I'm just skeptical of war, being able to end war. I have never seen that happen. And one aspect that you are mentioning this evening, and that is coming up in your book, one underlying thread is around knowing ourselves and trusting ourselves, building confidence, and being open to our shadow, our darker side, and revealing that. There's a couple of quotes in your book. One is from James Joyce. Mistakes are portals of discovery. And then another that I love, Allen Ginsberg saying, follow your inner moonlight. Don't hide the madness. And you also quote from Julian Assange, who has helped to reveal madness, shadow, darkness, and has himself been attacked, which is typical, not surprising. Bradley Manning as well, who apparently has undergone torture by the U.S. government. Would you say a little about Julian Assange, the power of revealing darkness and the potential for change by such revelation?
You know, my immediate response is I go to these different circumstances. Mohamed Bouazizi of Tunisia, I think of the 16 nuns and monks and lay men and women in Tibet who have immolated themselves, John, in 2011 and here in 2012. I think of this unthinkable gentleman in a brig who had the courage to care, as Aung San Suu Kyi has said, about what is the operative consciousness to transform dictatorships, to care about things larger than your own self-interest. He is a vital expression of courage and action. Caring about our president, our military, our planet, more than the very people are who are in power. Julian Assange, it reminds me of what the former or the late Congressman Tom Lantos once said. I was listening to him on the radio, and he was asked, "Sir, you survived Auschwitz. Surely you must have had remarkable, mind-blowing memories that have impacted everything in your life. Would you care to share something from your time in the camp? The most lasting image?" He said, "There are many, but the more lasting image for me was before I went to Auschwitz on the platform waiting for the train, looking around at my fellow brothers and sisters, and we all knew where we were going. And everyone had an eye of resignation. And that resignation haunted me for my years at Auschwitz. We knew where we were going, and we just stood there." I heard once, John, that those who fought and rebelled in the Warsaw Ghetto had a higher percentage of survival than those who went to the camps. Julian Assange, these monks and nuns in Tibet, the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement, the revolutions in Burma, the Saffron Revolution in 2007, and the monks and the nuns that stood up to dictatorship that were killed, some of them now released, political prisoners all over the world. Well, what would we have liked to have done differently? Mr. Lantos concluded with, why didn't someone throw themselves in front of the tracks? Why didn't someone just scream out in revolution? Why wasn't there rebellion? Why did we not dissent? And I think that's what's being done here. I think that's what Julian Assange did, what he's doing, the Occupy movement, Burma's revolution of the spirit. Each of us who are breathing and living the best possible transformational intelligence that keeps the oxygen of freedom high in the sky, of clarity and purity and human rights and freedom of speech, and Radio Free Santa Cruz that's allowed because of the courage of the people to broadcast, to broadcast, to broadcast. Let freedom be spoken, thought, felt, acted upon. Let's not tolerate this train, this locomotive, by a few people who pirated the planet and commandeer this planet, this beautiful green sphere, down a road of ruin. Let's not have that eye of resignation. Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, unthinkable courage in Tibet today. Why isn't the world doing more? Blows my mind. What's going on in Tibet that's moving these monks and nuns to burn themselves? That is not something I can fathom, except that they're showing us what the ultimate act of compassion looks like. Do you guys hear what we hear? Can you come here? Can you help us? Can you remove this repression, this oppression from our country? Where are you, President Obama? So all these remarkable stars in the world of dissent, these revolutionaries, I think we're in a global constellation right now that's so active and so dynamic. It's a process, a Dharma process, an intelligence, an interactive transformational intelligence that's linking up. People are linking up. We're in this huge interrelated network of transformational wisdom that says oxygen is freedom. Freedom is the ability to live in peace without fear. And I think that's what we're in right now, is a global revolution. And if I could say it, you know, that is the future that I do believe in, is, you know, right now, to enact principles of peace the best that we can and begin to envision a future where there is the absence of violence, and who knows what kind of sacred ecosystem will emerge from the naturalness of peace. I think we're beginning to see it more and more, because there's not just light at the end of the tunnel. I think there's a big, bright, open sky here. And the more that we stand up and live our revolution. In Burma, when I asked her, Aung San Suu Kyi, what does revolution look like on a day-to-day basis? Question authority. Do not believe your fear. Act despite your fear. Act with conscience. A revolution of the spirit is to understand the forces of denigration and oppression are within you. Overcome them to the best that you can. Challenge their presence and act into the high sky of your dignity, your love, your metta, your karuna, your compassion, your wisdom. And remember, the courage to care about things larger than your own self-interest. Treat each other as your brother. You've got to make peace. And in Burma, that's the one thing that they've got going there, is when people are asked in the opposition movement why they do what they do, because my freedom and their freedom are interrelated. I can never be free without he or her being free. And I've heard that, John, even from people who are being tortured by someone. Why are you struggling for democracy? For your sake. Our freedom is indivisible. And I think that's the oxygen analogy, that the more we wake up to this preciousness, you know, there's no amount of money and power and prestige that can buy you fresh air. But we can all participate in doing that which is required to eliminate the toxicity and anti-life actions. You know, not only drive less, you know, give up your car and either bicycle, walk, public transportation, or electric cars. But just refuse to participate in anti-life actions. Just stop. Stop. And I think that's the revolution that we're looking at here, and I think that's, when I hear your question about these revolutionaries, I think, you know, sure, there are some that stand out more than others, but everyone can breathe and understand that there's no guarantee that our next breath will come when we exhale, and that we all treasure the quality of our oxygen in our lungs. And I think that's really what's at stake here, is just the beauty of freedom. You know, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, no one's going to remember my name, much less my book. But A Future to Believe In, what I do hope they'll remember is that the subtitle of this thing is The Art and Activism of Freedom. And that's what I love today, is that we're able to talk, relate, love, kiss, touch, hold, and breathe. And my daughter can grow up, and children can grow up, and hopefully occupy this planet in such a way that it opens up new dimensions of contact with other beings, and there's forms of travel that take us into places we've never known, inside and outside. So. John, I thank you from my heart for the opportunity to speak with you. You're the first person I have spoken to about my book, although it's been released now for 3 months, and I can say a deep, humble bow of gratitude for you and your courage to keep alive human rights and Dharma intelligence and being a dad and a parent and being in your own remarkable great leap forward with keeping this radio show so active and alive as an act of defiance and courage to care. So I thank you for that, John.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's great to speak with you, and I always learn from your writings and when you've come to Santa Cruz and done anti-performances. And speaking with you on the phone like this is always a joy. And I would love to pose one last question to you, Alan. I'd love to, if you're willing, I'd love to hear a little about your internal process, your experience yourself with experimenting with courage and with cultivating freedom and exploring your own inner violence or nonviolence. And I'm thinking of this partly because of some of the quotes in your book, A Future to Believe In, and what you were just saying about Tom Lantos and being on the way to Auschwitz and no one taking direct action. You write in A Future to Believe In that choice is always there. And it seems to me that one manifestation that is so dangerous with violence is people believing themselves that they don't have choice anymore and that they have no possibility for affecting their own life and the world around them. In the same realm, you quote Aung San Suu Kyi as saying, "Nobody can detain your mind." And another quote that is really such an important couple of sentences for me, Viktor Frankl, who was also in a Nazi concentration camp, said that between the stimulus and the response, there is a space, and in that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lie our growth and our freedom. I wonder if you're willing to say a little about your own experiments with growth and freedom.
You know, what comes to mind, John, there's... In 1990, I went deep into the jungles of Burma. This was shortly after the uprising there, where 1 million people took to the streets, and people might remember that this was a year before the Tiananmen Square massacre. And here it is 23 years later that in that August 1988 period in Burma, we're seeing the fruition of this remarkable 23-year struggle for freedom. And shortly after the revolution began in 88, the country was closed, and I snuck into the country for several months. And many of those students that were killed during that week, I think there was upwards of 3,000 to 4,000, were killed at short range and bayoneted, some as young as 7. About 10,000 students fled to the jungle areas. And about 300 miles from Bangkok, deep into the jungles, we went in and I met with groups of them, 200 or 300 at a time, living in these malaria-infested jungles. They were singing nightly love songs with guitars. They'd been out there for about a year. Boys and girls, 18, 19, 20, 21. Some of them with master's degrees, some of them studying to be doctors, dentists, teachers. It was the intelligentsia of the country. It was quite a remarkable period. I remember going out on a foray once with a small band of some of the students that had actually taken up the weapon, despite the fact that Burma in the country itself was seen as a nonviolent revolution. This band of students took up guns. They said that, how can you stand up to the tyrant? Very much like what Nelson Mandela argued to move the ANC away from years of nonviolence. How can you tame the wild beast with your hands, he said. So they had a shift towards selective use of violence towards non-human targets, but I think some people did get killed. And so these students took up that belief. And I was out on a parole or patrol with them, and there was a firefight in which there was some of the students were killed, and one of my friends in this, who I'd been a monk with, was killed. That was a very alarming and troubling experience, to go from sitting in silence and walking in meditation, sending thoughts of metta, eating in silence in a monastery, practicing mindfulness, and to see in a short period of time this young man to disrobe and take up armed resistance to a maniacal, genocidal army at that time. And that night, this is a very personal experience, while some of the students went out on patrol to look at how we could have been wiped out and likely would be wiped out, I was told, since I was a non-combatant, here, take this pistol and I want you to guard one of the enemy soldiers, which they had captured. And here I was, left alone in this bunker with this Burmese soldier who had been captured, who may have been the one who killed my friend. And here I am sitting in this thing alone with a gun in his head. I'm thinking how easy it would be to kill him. Like, why shouldn't I? He just killed someone I loved. He just killed someone I love. That's the hook. He just violated. And he's looking at me hour after hour after hour. And then he asked if he can pull something out of his pocket, and I didn't know whether it was a trick or not, and I became very tense, and I spoke a bit of Burmese and said, okay, but be cool. And he pulled out from his back pocket a picture of himself as a monk, and he had a tear in his eye, John, as he explained to me that he had been a former monk himself before he was conscripted into the army and forced into this role to kill. If he didn't, he would be killed. That was his story. And here I was with this archetypal dilemma, him having killed my friend who was a former monk, and I'd been a monk in his country, and he had been a former monk, and we're all meeting in this moment of life and death and rage and retribution and revenge and forgiveness, and he's begging me with his eyes and his tears, and I don't know whether it's a ploy or the truth, and the whole planet was in this conundrum of who do you believe to stop killing in the name of justified killing. And he just wept. And I think that somehow speaks to that place in me where it's hard to see the tears beneath the arrogance. But I think if the right people walked up close to the circumstances of hell, the little boy and girl in Baghdad, that again, that nun in Lhasa, the political prisoner that still remain in prison in Burma, just see suffering and tears up close and see that everyone is crying, the archetypal fear of what am I doing? What is this about? What is this brain-generated phantasm of existence creating here? I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know why I did it. I'm deluded. I killed. Can we stop harming each other? And who can see beneath that and see the tears, the ocean of tears? This man killed someone, and he genuinely cracked his soul and his conscience wide open. He just cried and he cried and he cried. cried and he cried and he cried. And that story has always stayed with me. If only there was more opportunities to see that even the most profoundly wealthy, arrogant dictator in Burma who has everything is alone in a bunker with his family and he has nothing right now. He sees the fate of Gaddafi, of Mubarak, and goes, wow, this woman Aung San Suu Kyi is someone I should trust. And maybe I pray that that act of redemption there and reconciliation going on in Burma right now becomes a torch of global revolution that shows us the wisdom of laying down the weapon and saying, give peace a chance. Let's talk about it. Let's learn the power to talk rather than the power of fear that promotes the gun. So I would like to leave with that and pray that I have the courage to also restrain from forms of aggression. I know that I'm prone or able to. It's inevitable. Circumstances could happen where I am that soldier, as Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk, has often said. How easy it is to be the very person that we judge. If I were born into those circumstances, I too could possibly be the Thai pirate that raped the Vietnamese girl. So to understand systemically why people do what they do, again, comes back to a self-confidence built by personal understanding, thus coming back to the very core of this issue, a revolution of the spirit. And I think that's the future to believe in, that we can participate in change if we choose to see the change as possible. In ourselves first, and in others simultaneously. Thus, the Dharma intelligence or the transformational intelligence, the interactive revolution, I can't be free without you.
A Future to Believe In, 108 Reflections on the Art and Activism of Freedom, is the new book by Alan Clements from World Dharma Publications. You can find out more at afuturetobelievein.com and worlddharma.com. And Alan, I want to thank you for being here this evening. I really deeply appreciate, especially your last story you were telling, your willingness to share these kinds of personal stories, your authenticity and your honesty. These things really inspire me in my life, and I want to thank you for that and for putting this book together, A Future to Believe In.
John, a real honor, and thank you, and thank your extraordinarily courageous, supportive listeners locally and worldwide. May this revolution carry on. Thank you from my heart.
Thank you. I wish you well.
And you too.
Good night.
Good night.